Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and got some old friends in here today.
Hey, man, this is old home week. Well, we're going to get a chance to welcome two guests back to the Business Radio X microphone. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast CMO with Sage, Mr. Ron McMurtry. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, Ron, before we get too far into things, can you tell us about Sage? Anything new going on?
We've got a lot going on. We're focused on building great products for small and mid-sized markets based here in North America for Atlanta, but Sage is a global company, so we have customers in over 120 markets and focused on bringing payment solutions, accounting and financial solutions, and HR solutions to serve those customers.
Now, we're here to talk about an initiative about kind of tie into an underserved group that maybe isn't getting the love that some of the other organizations are getting.
Well, we've focused on a lot of different verticals, but what we've done is we've really shifted our focus to make sure that our customers and all of our verticals are getting attention. So our solutions are becoming more and more tailored for the markets that they serve.
And then, but some of these, there's a push for diversity and inclusion that I'm sure it's always been going on, but now there's more energy towards it.
Separate and apart from our technology, Sage in the market has been very much focused on diversity and inclusion. It's something that actually I lead for the company. I'm one of the sponsors for, and we recently did a study in the Atlanta market along with many of our other business colleagues and pulled together a group and did some research on the state of diversity and inclusion in the market. We believe that diversity and inclusion allows colleagues to bring their whole self to the office, and that leads to greater curiosity, better output, better products, and ultimately leads to better innovation.
Right, and it's been going on, but it's kind of new also.
Well, it's not a new thing. I think businesses and their social sense are applying much more to diversity, inclusion, and it's not just about race and it's not just about gender. It's about looking at the whole colleague and all their different perspectives and bringing it together. So I wouldn't say that D&I is a new thing, but it's something that's taken a much higher place on the corporate stage as companies are looking to provide more diverse workplaces and honor colleagues across the board.
So now how does that get rolled out at Sage? Like, how do you say, okay, we're doing this and we're doing this, you know, for everybody?
Because nobody says, no, we're not going to do that, right? Yeah. Like, well, nobody puts their foot down and says, you know what, guys, no. Yeah, that doesn't happen.
It's not a program for us. It's the way we work. It's part of our culture. It's part of our values. You know, we have colleague programs to allow colleagues to pursue their interests and invest. We have our foundation that allows colleagues to express themselves in the marketplace and serve areas of focus for themselves. So if you look at Sage and the way we work, one of the things we're very well known for is how we handle diversity and inclusion in terms of investing in our colleagues and doing that in a uniform way.
Now, if you were to work with your clients now, how do you help them kind of be better at this?
We just walk our own. We talk and we walk our talk.
You're role modeling the behavior.
That's correct.
So is there anything that you have in place to help if a company says, hey, we want to be better at this? Do you do anything to help?
We have a series of case studies and work that we've done around the globe. In fact, just this week, we have a program called AI for Good, and we're actually taking and teaching AI to women and underserved youth and markets so that they can develop and enter the tech marketplace in a way that they wouldn't be
so AI, artificial intelligence.
That's correct.
So how does that work?
Well, how that works is we're teaching kids how to program for the future. And we're doing it all in all of our major markets right now. And
so you're going into the schools, or that's an after school program?
It's an after school program that, and what we do, we've created this teaching environment. In fact, just today, we're in South Africa, in Cape Town, and we have a whole auditorium full of young children, primarily girls, and teaching them how to code and how to use AI so that they can be prepared for the future. That in a very broad definition is one of the ways that we approach diversity and inclusion.
Now, your partners are important to you in terms of growing as well. What do you do for your partners?
Our partners are an extension of our colleague base. I mean, they run their own business. They have their own practice, but the same values we have, we expect them to follow also, because we serve our customers in a whole product kind of way. So whether we use a partner to bring a piece of technology in or a partner to help implement our solution, we treat our partners to deliver in a way that delivers a whole product solution. And we share our values with them and practice them together.
Right. Because Sage is software, right? That's at the heart of it, where people can use and do their payroll and books, things like that. And then you have the partners that could be a CPA, bookkeeper, people that have clients that are, they are encouraged to use Sage that helps them do their job better.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we have a whole variety of different, we partner with accountants and bookkeepers,
right,
to help our customers. We partner with ISVs that bring technology into our solution to help extend it in some way. And we partner with value-added resellers or VARs that also help implement our software on behalf of our clients. So if it's an implementation for, let's say, a mid-market customer, they'll come and do some customization and some tailoring of that solution to tune it to that customer's exact needs.
But the customer for Sage could be a small mom and pop, one person solopreneur all the way up, right?
That's right. We serve small and medium businesses, and that's where we focus all of our solutions.
So early in the conversation, you said, look, at Sage, diversity and inclusion, it's not a program. It's a value system. But I got to suspect, at least in some organizations, that's at least where they have to start, right, is do something proactive and install a program. What advice, if any, do you have to offer leadership in companies that genuinely would like to graduate from program and move in the direction of value system?
Yeah. Well, I think it starts with connecting with your colleagues. And what we've done is we've done a series of initiatives. We did this thing called the Big Conversation, which was an open chat for 3 days where colleagues from around the globe could express their views and share their opinions. And we use that input along with these things we call pulse surveys, which is really gauges the heartbeat of the organization. We use the data and information from that to help really structure our values. So our values are obviously company led, but they're rooted at the cause that our employees value also. So we bring together both colleagues and our overall company structure to make sure that, you know, we're really walking the talk.
Now, did anything come of that surprised you?
Yeah, we blew up the system. It was it was actually an amazing outcome of this partner we worked with said they have never seen so much traffic or so much engagement of any company our size in their years of doing this. And what it really showed is that we have a really engaged colleague base, and it's one that, you know, takes things that matter to them and they express it. And they also said that in many times colleagues come to these forums and they cite the problem. Our colleagues came and cited the solution. Which was
so. When you say cite the problem, they just kind of complain about,
Yeah, or express their view.
Uh huh.
Yeah,
and then when they come with a solution, they're like, "But here's a better way.
Here's a way of doing it. Here's a way we can serve our customers." Mm-hmm. I mean, Sage is all about serving our customers, and we believe we can serve them in a much better way through diversity and inclusion and through building great product.
So I have a question on this innovation, just from a very practical standpoint. You do that. You start listening. What a fantastic idea! A lot of these ideas are probably good, many of them practical, but some of them maybe you don't feel like you can implement yet, maybe never, but you don't want to shut them down, right? So how do you manage this increasing pile of ideas, knowing you cannot or will not implement them all, but still keep people engaged?
Yeah, well, you're going to have I think we have somebody else on today that's going to talk about making great products, I'm sure.
Right, and we've got his mic open too.
He'll have some perspective right on that. But we have a lot of forums. We have this forum called The Big Idea, where colleagues are encouraged to express their ideas and suggest ideas. But all of our innovation ideas go through a process of sorting those best ones, and we sequence them because they're all grounded based on customer needs. They're all grounded based on the market we're serving. And today we're in 23 markets, which equals several hundred customers that roll in, several hundred countries that roll into those markets. So, you know, when things are grounded on customer need, the right priorities come out and they get sequenced.
Now, how are you serving the Atlanta community since you're here?
Yep. We're headquartered here, and the Atlanta community is a big part of what we're doing. We have partnerships with the universities. We have partnerships with TAG. We have partnerships with the Chamber. And, you know, we have well over 300 plus colleagues in this market between Lawrenceville and our Midtown location. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is where decisions get made of how we serve the U.S., but we have a very large client base here and a very large colleague base.
Now, is there any kind of niches that you serve more than others, or do you? It's kind of any business fits the bill for a Sage customer.
When you in the small business marketplace, we really build our products for scale to serve a variety of customer needs, and those get tailored based on the various ISV solutions that get brought into them. Those are solutions that help extend the product to certain verticals. Mm-hmm. When we get into the mid market. We do specialize some. We specialize a lot on nonprofit, on the services industry, on tech, and in manufacturing and food and beverage. And those are some really strong sweet spots for us.
And then in those given groups, are there kind of groups within groups where they help each other and have best practices and users groups and things like that?
Yeah, of course. Like any software company, we have forums that bring colleagues together. We just had one in April here for our summit. Where we brought customers and our partners together and ideated on different needs and helped develop their skills within our software. But we have user groups and forums to always help to improve and give us feedback.
So the whole sales and marketing thing for a company that is at the maturity level that yours is it all coming in? Is it creating these ecosystems, these opportunities, and then people come to you and these trusted advisors learn that they can capitalize on your technology to serve their customers better? Or do you have to have people out there sort of shaking the bushes and knocking on doors as well still, even now?
No, we're far from an order taking industry. We are in every customer's business and trust. So we have teams that serve our clients and do business development and engage with customers in the marketplace, and that we are in every customer that we get. Our industry is far from one that's an order taking industry. We tailor our solutions to their needs and go out and
so you have people that are out in the marketplace talking, having conversations with these CPAs
every day. We have whole groups that just serve that population and their needs, and making sure that our solutions are helping them run their practices more efficiently. Because it's not just about them, you know, using our software, but it also has to help their practice.
Right.
And the accountancy practice is evolving as things like AI and other things come into play. You know, accountancy practices are getting more into advisory services, not just closing the books. Yeah. And we're working to evolve our capabilities in a way that helps them do that.
So that goes well beyond the nuts and bolts of the software at that point, right?
That's why you need a CMO.
Yeah. Well, right. Usability of the software is as much as the capabilities of it. So
right. But if you're looking at holistically trying to help them grow their business, I mean, the software is a tool to help them grow their business, but you're looking, it seems, to kind of have a higher impact than just give them a good tool.
Well, the table stakes are having great applications that solve their needs and helps them be compliant and helps their business run. We believe true customer success is about helping customers grow their business, helping the people we sell to grow their practices, grow their business in a way that creates long-lasting relationships. So to do that, those applications have to be very tailored and continue to evolve with how the business is evolving.
And it has to be very relationship. This is about a relationship. It's not about just kind of plug and play and thank you, pay the subscription every month.
Well, with over 3 million customers, we have to have those relationships, because in a subscription business, it's if you are, there's a constant expectation to be improving capabilities and serving this. You cannot, the the word subscription is an active word in the first place.
Right.
It implies you gotta earn it. It implies month. A two-way relationship. Mm-hmm. And for all subscriptions we each have, when they're not serving us, we look. And for Sage, we feel the best way to do it is to continue to listen to our customers, serve them with the right kind of capabilities, help bring new things that will help them be more productive, and always ensure that they've got the right tools in place to be compliant.
So now what's on your roadmap for next year?
We continue to focus on simplifying and removing the admin burden from our customers and our software.
To make it just as easy and seamless as possible.
Yeah, so like just recently we did an acquisition, and the company's name is AutoEntry, and that is about ingesting receipts into the general ledger automatically.
Mm-hmm.
So think of all that entry that customers do today. If you can ingest that information and put that automatically in your general ledger, the productivity gains and the accuracy that comes with that. So it's those types of things that we're looking at to just automate, drive more automation into our software, more intelligence that helps free up time for our customers.
What about in Atlanta? Are there any events coming up?
We'll have our summits here in the start. We're wrapping up our fiscal year today, actually, and we'll be launching our whole calendar of a program shortly.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best point of entry?
Sage.com.
Well, thanks so much for coming back and keeping us posted on what you're doing, man, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, appreciate it. It's always a great, great dialogue.
Yeah. Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with one more guest this morning.
Good deal.
All right, Lee, you ready for this one?
I am.
Okay. Please join me in welcoming back to the Business Radio X microphone, founder and president with Nine Labs, Mr. Jay Cornelius. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Yes, sir. What'd you learn in that last segment, man?
Well, it confirmed more than I learned is that Sage is doing things right. I've known a few people who have worked there over the years, and they always seem to have a good pulse on what their customers need. And I think to build on some of that conversation, if I may, you were asking questions about what do you do to keep customers engaged, like how do you reach out and how do you make sure that you're doing the right thing? And one of the things that kind of got said but didn't get said as clearly as I want to bring it up is there's a difference between creating software features and creating software value. And the way that we think about that is in measuring features and benefits. Features are things like ingesting all of your receipts so you don't have to type it in. The benefit of that is more time back in your day or more focus to do something else. And so anytime you can do that with a product, you're creating value for the customer. And you know, as Rob said about subscriptions, you're being evaluated every time that subscription renews on whether or not you're doing a good job. And if that's monthly, quarterly, annually, whatever, a software business, especially a subscription software business, has to think about how do you continually create value for your customers ahead of subscription time so when that bill comes, they just don't think about paying it anymore.
So now in your work, how are you working with customers to help them kind of create these products that matter and that have the impact that everybody wants them to have?
It really comes down to a five-step process or a five-phase process that begins with research, is understanding what your market is and understanding what your market needs. Then you prototype a solution that can answer those needs for that customer base. Very precise, very accurate, understanding what that person needs or what that market needs and creating something that is actually going to demonstrate value for them. Then designing that thing into an actual product. Because when it's in the prototyping stage, it's still just kind of an idea, right? We call it a hunch. It's like you've got this idea that something's going to work. Then when you actually create a product and bring it into market, that's the design phase of getting through turning an idea from something in your head or on the whiteboard into something that's actually in the real world. Then you go through branding and positioning and all of that stuff and building a scale.
So now in your world, is a product a physical, tangible item, or can it be, you know, a service as well?
Both. So in the book, I say that we condense the idea of products and services down into a concept of a product because it's easier to talk about that way. It's the result of an effort. It's the output of the design process is a product, whether that's a software service or an app that's on your phone or a physical product like this microphone I'm talking into. The core principles of how you get something from that idea stage into something that someone can buy and use are generally the same.
Now, is there any mistakes you see companies make or people make when they have this idea for a product and then they're trying to actually create it?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is just rushing to market with something that you haven't proven, is not doing enough research and not really understanding what it is that you need to create to actually generate some value for the customer.
But when they say, when some people go, well, I did research, my wife loves this.
Right. You know, yeah.
My employees think it's great. We should do it.
Yeah. An audience of one. I mean, if your wife is going to pay for the rest of your life, then that's fine. But if you have an audience of one, then that's a very limited worldview. And so, you're never going to scale a business based off of one person's feedback.
So how much research and how do you go about doing that in kind of a semi-efficient way, at least?
There's a few ways to do it. Like if what we recommend people do, if they have an idea. So generally, ideas come from a couple places. They come from somebody who feels a problem and they want to find a way to solve it, or somebody who sees a problem and they want to find a way to solve it. In the case of somebody who sees a problem, you can typically hone in on a particular group of people. So in your world, it's accounting and people, small business owners, right? And so what problem are you going to solve for that group of people? Well, what you have to do is go talk to those people. The easy way to do that is find what we call watering holes. Where do these people hang out and talk about their business? Is it online forums? Is it meetups? Is it other types of events? Where are they going to talk about these problems with other people who have similar problems? And just go and be an observer. Just listen. Just go see what's going on there and see what you can pick up from those regular conversations. Don't try to influence them into believing that you have something that can help them.
I bet that's a hard discipline right there, though. Right? Not trying to influence the conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
I bet that's easier said than done, I bet.
It's one of the core mistakes is when you get into a conversation with someone, you're like, oh, well, have you tried this or have you tried that? Right? And you start badgering them with all this information instead of listening to what they're saying. And the core of all of this is empathy. It's trying to understand what that person is dealing with from their perspective. And it's really, really difficult to do.
So now, if by doing this kind of research and listening to the customer, can you kind of get a feel for something that is going to be a big disruption? Like, could you have done that and then gotten the iPod
or Uber?
Like, you know, everybody's like, well, I hate cabs, you know, like, am I going to trust going in someone else's car?
Yeah, that's so. In the case of Uber, that's a big risk. And Travis and I actually talked about this when Uber launched in Atlanta at the launch party, about where they thought Uber could go compared to where it was at that time. And then, of course, you know, this is 6-7 years later, so it's even bigger now. And they were just trying to solve a simple problem that they had. They started with the pain. I don't know if you know that story, but they were sitting on a curb in Paris trying to find a taxi, and they're like, wouldn't it be awesome if I could just call a cab with my phone? And so essentially they're like, well, actually, it'd be even more awesome if you could call a black car with your phone, right? And it's something the Airbnb folks talk about, taking it to 11. How do you create value for somebody and then turn it up to make it really, really cool? Could they have known that it was going to be as disruptive as it is? I think you have a hint of that, but I think you don't ever really know.
Right, but even Uber started, like you said, about wanting that black car, which was just saying taking a black car that most of the time is sitting idle and just using the black car. To me, the disruption was I'm getting my neighbor down the street's car, and he's, you know, stopping watching television to pick me up now, and I'm trusting that.
Right, so that wasn't the initial... The initial thought was, I want to be able to call a car from my phone.
Right.
The thing about getting somebody that you don't know, a stranger from down the street or just a regular person who's got a regular car to come pick you up, came later when they were trying to solve the challenge of demand. So how do we actually get enough cars on the street? Because they grew fast enough. The idea was sticky enough for people to say, yeah, I want a black car. And it blew up in San Francisco. So how do you satisfy that demand when you start to scale out? And so the solution of getting regular people to drive regular cars was a factor of satisfying that demand, not part of the original idea.
But my point was, could you have gleaned that from research?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you have to figure out how you're going to solve problems. And the only way to figure that out is to ask questions, and that's the core of research. So they probably went out and I don't know much about how they decided to make that switch, but they probably went out and started talking to people and maybe just even tried a few things. Like, well, we don't have enough black cars. So would people take a regular car? And so how are we going to do that? Maybe they actually got in the cars and drove them around. I mean, I've heard of similar stories where entrepreneurs just go and you know, guerrilla research methods. And if they saw that that was working, then you can work towards scaling it up.
So now how much time should you spend on this research? part?
The best companies always do research. They never stop doing research. So how much time should you spend on it? As much as you possibly can. In the early days, that's really, really tough, because if you're a one-man show, then you have to do all of the work. You have to do all the accounting. You have to do all the sales. You have to do all the business development. You have to do all the product development. You have to do everything. So you have a limited amount of time. But the more research you can do, the more confidence you can get in your idea.
Is there a way to get kind of a bigger bang for your buck, your research time?
I wish there was a shortcut, but there really isn't. The best thing to do is just try to talk to as many people as possible. One of the things, going back to one of your questions about the mistakes people make, is they also don't target precisely enough. So they'll say, my product is for women between 25 and 35 who live in Atlanta. And that's just nowhere near precise enough. And so the more precise you get with who you're trying to solve a problem for, the easier it is to identify those people and the less people you have to talk to get real information.
But how can you tell if they would buy it as opposed to they'd like it?
Yeah, we talk about this a little bit in the book too, is there are buying signals. Obviously, if someone asks you, like, hey, how much for this? Like, that's a good buying signal. There's a fundamental rule in psychology that is a good indicator of whether or not someone will buy something or not. And it's called exchange theory. And it's essentially, if the perceived cost of something is less than the perceived value, people will buy that, or people will make that exchange. If the perceived cost is higher than the perceived value, they won't. It's a very simple equation, and the key word is perceived, because you can create value in terms of time, money, effort. There's a lot of different ways to measure that. There's also a lot of different ways to measure cost. Like, if this is going to take me 5 hours to do, but it's going to have a tremendous value on the other side, like a workshop or something that is really going to, maybe like driving to another city, but you get to see something really awesome, or you get to spend time with friends or family. Like, that's worth that investment of cost. Cost is time, but the value is that time spent with people that you care about. In the case of a product, someone's going to say, well, this task is going to cost me 5 hours to do manually, or I could pay Sage some money and it'll do it for me automatically, right? And so that's where they make that value assessment. And so if you can demonstrate, and this is what's called value propositions, if you can demonstrate a good value proposition by really understanding somebody's needs, and you can articulate that, we know that you are frustrated because you can't accomplish this task fast enough. Our solution does it for you. That's automatically a very compelling value proposition. And so the chance of them buying that is exponentially increased.
What about when, like, we get to interview a lot of startups, and it seems like there's so many startups, and every day there's a new startup, and they all seem to be kind of hanging around the same watering hole.
Mm-hmm.
How do you kind of differentiate yourself in a meaningful way to stand out and to make margins that can allow you to succeed rather than kind of get into a price war?
Yeah, a thing I see a lot of startup founders struggle with is getting caught up in entrepreneurship, is just like getting caught up in the scene of being a startup person.
Right.
Is that's not super helpful. Like, it's always good to hang out with people who have the similar problems as you, because you can, you know, one, know that you're not the only one who's crazy in doing this. But more startup founders need to go out and spend time with their customers and spend time building a product that people will actually use. Going to these startup events all the time and being involved in the startup community is nice, but it's not going to help you grow your business.
Unless that's where your customers are?
Unless that's where your customers are. But if you're a startup serving startups, startups don't have money.
Right.
So that's really a difficult place to make a living.
So you shouldn't be marinating in the startup ecosystem that much. You should kind of dip your toe in it, but focus more on the...
I think it's good to stay connected to that, because there's a lot of wisdom and there's a lot of people who have been through those things before that they can help you and maybe help you avoid some mistakes or be smarter about making some decisions. But that's not where you should be spending most of your time.
Now, what about, let's look at the other side of the coin, the enterprise level customer, the enterprise level company. How are they kind of getting a dose of that startup energy and passion and innovation? What are some things they can be doing?
Yeah, well, one of the things they can be doing is just be willing to take more risk. A lot of enterprises they're doing a couple of things. They're either defending their territory or they're trying to grow their market, and they're very risk averse in doing that,
right?
Because there's a lot on the line. you work with a billion-dollar company and they're spending $100 million on a project, that's a big, big risk for them. So,
and you got to realize you drill that down. There's somebody's neck on the line. It's not like a big company. It's Bob.
Right. Yeah. It's whoever has P&L responsibility for that project.
So
yeah.
He might work for the big company, but he's the one that they're going to go, hey, what happened there? We spent a lot of money on that and didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's really just a matter of getting comfortable with a little bit more risk. A lot of companies give the window dressing of innovation. They'll set up like an innovation lab somewhere, or they'll have some projects that are kind of off on the side, but they're still contained in some way, right? It might be budget. It might be resources in some other way. It'd be nice if some companies actually embraced innovation as a core principle, kind of like you were talking about with diversity and inclusion, right? That needs to be a core principle.
Like it's part of the DNA.
It's part of the DNA of the company. And that's why startups, particularly all this stuff coming out of the tech world, move faster and get more done than legacy companies, is because it's built into the DNA.
Well, they're iterating. They have to or they die.
Exactly. All and right, big companies iterate too. They just don't iterate quite as quickly.
But an enterprise-level organization, can they create some of these watering holes, right?
Yeah, like, absolutely. They already have some of these watering holes.
Right, so they can build them out.
Yeah. Well, so you said you had 300 million customers or something.
3 million.
3 million customers. Okay, so there's 3 million people. That's a massive market. I guarantee you there is a group of people in that market they already have that is underserved in some way. Mm-hmm. What we call this the adjacent possible. So if you look at the customers you already have in that case, and any enterprise can do this, look at customers they already have, look at the things they're already delivering to those customers, and then do a lot of work and dig in, do some research, and find the adjacent need that they have that you can solve with the skills and services you already have on board. And that's a good way to think about expanding your products kind of organically and providing more value to the customers you already have. A customer you already have costs a whole lot less than a new one to find, right?
Here again, though, that same discipline, just like we talked about as an individual, it would be tough for me, right? I've kind of got like this sales and marketing DNA in me. I'm wanting to sort of inject my new idea into the conversation. An enterprise could create the watering hole, tap into this constituency, and they too need to exercise the discipline of really listening to what that
exactly.
customer, instead of putting their brand new product in there.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. That's a balance. Yeah.
Well, we've all experienced this. Somebody comes to us with a product or service and they're trying to sell it to us without understanding our needs first, and it doesn't work. Right? Picture going to a car lot. Someone walks up to you. You go to a car lot to buy a truck because you need to move things around in a truck, and someone comes up to you and tries to sell you a sports car right away. Like, no sale. Right? But if they had taken the time to ask you a handful of questions first, then you'd have a better chance of making that sale. You understand the customer's needs before you try to sell them something.
Well, tell us about the new book, Loops.
So Loops is, it's about 45,000 words of how to build products with clarity and confidence. It takes you through those five steps I mentioned earlier, and it does it in a kind of a practical, pragmatic way. The loops are essentially to try to get people to understand that this is not a one-time process, that you don't do research and then do prototyping and then build the product and then never go back to research. You're constantly iterating through these different loops of understanding the customer and building something that satisfies that need. It's a constant switch between left and right brain, between creativity and analysis.
So now what drove you to write this?
Because
I've been making products
for the better part of 25 years, and I've just seen these things happen over and over and over again, and I've noticed these patterns. And this is a lot of the stuff that we help our customers with and our clients with, is getting through this initial how do we build something people want phase. And so it felt like it was the right time to put it all down on paper so that we could say, look, here's a reference you can use. Here's something that you can use day to day as a good guide for how to manage this process. And it just felt like we answered these questions enough, and we answered them the same way often enough that it was just time to write it down.
So now in the products that you've worked with over the years, is there any product that stands out on one that you're like, man, that one was great. We made really a big impact, a lot more than I anticipated.
I wouldn't say there's any one standout, but the one that often comes up in conversation is going back to the late 90s when we started making software for websites. The thing that I think was the most impactful was seeing other people with their ideas and put their ideas online, whether that be for a business or for a community or for whatever, selling their art, whatever it might be. They're just giving people the power to harness what was the very early stages of the internet, to build something, to get what they wanted to talk about online and to create a community or create a customer base around their ideas. I think that was the thing that sticks with me the most.
Now, are you seeing kind of more design nowadays, or are people getting better at it? Or is this something that's kind of people take for granted, or they're not doing as much as you'd like?
In my opinion, people misunderstand the concept of design. People think about design as a bit of a process, but more of the finished product. You'll hear people say, I don't like the design of that thing. But design is the process, right? Design is a verb. And as a conversation that I had on Twitter last week, I think it's both a noun and a verb. That's true. But we need to be focusing more about the verb part of design, is that it's a process of getting ideas out of your head and into the real world. Are people getting better at it? I think people are understanding it better. But there's always going to be someone who doesn't do it well, and there's always going to be someone who does it exceptionally well.
And then what are some examples of people or companies that do it exceptionally well?
In the digital space, I like what Airbnb is doing. I think as contrast to that, I think we can all see that Facebook is not doing a very good job. I mean, the app is easy to use, but the core principles that drive the behavior are probably not as good as they should be and need some governance. I think we see that same kind of thing with Uber, where like they get out of their skis a little bit. There's some companies here in town that are doing it really well. I think MailChimp is an excellent example of a company who stays very, very customer focused. Their key executives still go out and do one-on-one meetings with regular customers who are paying $29 a month to understand their needs and build stuff that satisfies that.
And is that a good practice you would recommend?
Absolutely.
Staying connected to your customers like every day?
Absolutely, as much as you possibly can. And one of the things that I admire most about MailChimp is that they still do that at the key executive level. There's no middleman in between. There's no telephone game between some junior person who's an intern doing research and maybe not doing it that well, all the way getting up to the people who are making decisions on how to lead the company. It is the people leading the company who are talking directly to customers, and that has a much, much more vivid impact on what your strategic direction is and then how you execute on that.
Right, and it's become part of the DNA of the organization.
Absolutely, from the very beginning.
Now, what about some tips for people out there and they're going to go talk to their customers for the first time? What are some things they should be asking?
One of the things they need to do first is understand their own bias, is know that there's this thing called the curse of knowledge, right? So everybody in this room speaks English. It's really, really hard for anybody here to imagine a world where you can't speak English, because that's an inherent knowledge you have. So that curse of knowledge prohibits a lot of people from really understanding what it's like to not know what you know. And so when you go and talk to customers who have no idea how your product works, you understand how your product might be able to solve their needs immediately, but they still don't even know what your product is. And so being able to remove that bias and try to, you know, have the mind of a child and listen to them from the perspective of, what if I didn't know this thing existed, or I don't know how to solve this problem? That's one of the key things that a lot of people just overlook, is not thinking through how do people make decisions and understanding kind of the core psychological principles that drive human behavior. I think if you can get a foundation in that, and that's actually what the first chapter of this book is about, then you can be much more effective in understanding your customer and creating ideas, or at least generating a way to solve their problem that's going to be more accurate than if you just kind of guessed or threw a dart.
And right now, what are the projects you're working on? What types of industries and companies?
So we've got a couple of very large companies that we're working with. We probably all use their products and services relatively frequently under NDA, so I can't really talk about that.
But it's like enterprise-level companies you're
enterprise
working with?
Enterprise software, B2B software, B2B2C software. Working with a few startups. We recently started an initiative where we've been partnered with some of the incubators around town for a while, so ATDC and Atlanta Tech Park and a few others. We started an initiative where we're doing more active mentoring, where we're choosing one company from each of those organizations and doing active mentoring completely free of charge to help them get up and out of the blocks.
So how do you choose that one?
Some of it's a selection process. Like we're working with the farm, the Comcast incubator. And so we went through a process of interviewing all the companies. Kind of, it's more like a date first date thing where they're interviewing us and we're interviewing them. And so they actually facilitated part of that selection process. In other cases, it's more organic. You meet somebody in an event and you're like, hey, I really like what you're doing. Let me help you out. In some cases, they come to us. And we get a lot of people who ask us questions. And when we find an idea that we think has some real merit and we see a founder who's coachable and who really wants to focus on solving the problem. One of the things we say also is you have to fall in love with the problem, not fall in love with your solution. And so when you see a founder who's fallen in love with a problem, that's the kind of founder we want to help.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the way to get a hold of the book and to get a hold of you?
You can go to ninelabs.com to see what we're working on and loopsbook.com to find the book.
And
it's on Amazon. And
nine spelled out or both ways?
NINELABS.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.